Our regular listeners may be wondering, what happened to Geared Up? Well, our weekly news show about gadgets, games, and hardware is still coming out every week, but it is in its own podcast feed. Subscribe to it by searching Geared Up in your favorite podcast app. And look for new episodes every Wednesday.
Coming up on The Week in Geek, a lawsuit over 3D printed guns took a turn this week when a judge blocked the release of manuals that show how to make them. But the legal battle is not over yet. Plus, Starbucks is teaming up with Amazon competitor Alibaba to deliver coffee in China. Can the retail giant find success overseas? And finally, grab your litter scoopers. There might just be valuable scientific data hiding in your pet's poop. Wow. From GeekWire.com in Seattle, I'm editor Todd Bishop.
I'm civic innovation editor Monica Nicholsberg.
And I'm podcast producer and life sciences reporter Claire McGreen.
Who has the scoop later on the poop.
Oh.
Sorry, I couldn't help it. All right,
okay,
let's start with a slightly more serious topic. Monica, you covered this court case this past week involving 3D printed guns. I was surprised by this whole issue. Can you catch us up to date on what happened here?
Sure. So it's actually a story that dates back to 2015 when this guy who describes himself as a crypto anarchist who runs an organization called Defense Distributed put out these plans for a 3D printed shotgun and actually showed how he was able to successfully make it. And the Obama administration sued the State Department. And they won two lawsuits. The Defense Distributed continued to appeal. But then this year, in kind of a surprising reversal, the Trump administration settled the lawsuit despite those victories and agreed to let this organization distribute the plans for 3D printed guns and actually also offered to pay some of their attorney fees.
Wow. So initially, the Obama administration sued to block this, won, and in other words, blocked the distribution of these blueprints. And for folks out there who might not be up to speed on all the 3D printing, it's basically like a printer where it's like the old dot matrix thing, except it's doing it in three dimensions. And you can use resin or plastics or other things to essentially layer by layer create different pieces of a product. And in this case, to my understanding, the idea is you create different parts of a gun, put it together, and this guy figured out how to make it work.
That's right. Yeah. So that was the initial lawsuit. And then this week, Washington State Attorney General led a multi-state lawsuit with a bunch of other attorneys general suing the Trump administration and saying that this violates a number of laws, including states' ability to regulate guns in their own jurisdictions.
So the ruling this week basically went back to where we were.
Kind of. It's a temporary restraining order. So Defense Distributed said, we are going to release these plans now that we have the green light from the federal government. And they said they were going to do it August 1st. So just hours before that, Ferguson and the others involved in this lawsuit were able to secure a temporary restraining order, which just blocks Defense Distributed from releasing the plans right now while the litigation continues.
This is really fascinating. You know, 3D printing, laser printing, all this stuff has been kind of bubbling up over the past few years. But it's also one of those things that initially seems like it's going to be much bigger than it is in the short term. And this, to me, is a fascinating example of how it actually is here. The practical implications are really significant. And I'm frankly more interested in the cool stuff, the useful and constructive stuff that it's going to be able to do, not to get into the whole gun debate. But wow, I would like to see problems being solved with 3D printing. I wish we weren't talking about this story right now. I wish that the big story was something really amazing and cool that everybody agreed was better for society as a result of 3D printing.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is whether it's to make weapons or to make things that will make the world a better place, all of this right now is limited by your access to a 3D printer. They're very expensive. And so even though these plans probably will end up being distributed. And we should say, you know, once something's on the internet, it's never really gone. So in this case, Defense Distributed was ordered to take the plans down, and they did, but they can still be accessed online. I don't think that you can put the cat back in the bag, really. But until 3D printers actually become more widely owned and used, we're sort of having the debate before it's really fully realized.
I should point out, too, there are many people who would say that for defense purposes, for personal security, the ability to print a 3D gun might be a benefit. So I don't want to, you know, come down on one side of this issue over the other. I just wish it was about something else.
Yeah, I mean, I think the concern isn't as much about people's right to have firearms as it is about not being able to trace them. They, at least people who are on the Ferguson side of this debate, call them ghost guns because anybody could make them at home. So somebody who's really not fit to have a firearm but does have access to a 3D printer and these plans could make one.
For example, a convict, someone who legally might not be allowed to have a firearm. I actually think what you said, Monica, about having the debate before the issue arises is really interesting because that's the opposite of what is happening in a lot of other, in most cases where technology and the law are starting to kind of come into conflict. It's because something has happened. Technology has made a possibility that wasn't possible before, and the law is now figuring out how to deal with it when it's already happening, regulating companies like Uber and Airbnb and Facebook and political ads on Facebook. Like, it's fascinating and almost refreshing to see this happen before all these ramifications start taking place.
Yeah. And another thing that's unique about this debate is that it's really unusual. Defense Distributed and the Second Amendment Foundation, the participants in this lawsuit, they're not actually claiming a Second Amendment right. They're claiming a First Amendment right, that it violates their free speech to be told they can't put this information on the internet because they're not selling the guns. They're not even selling the plans. They just want to share them.
That's really interesting. So on what basis did the judge issue the temporary restraining order then? Because, wow, that's the First Amendment twist puts a whole different spin on it.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. The original lawsuit cited gun export laws. And the case that Ferguson and other attorneys general were making was that this was a violation of their right as states to regulate guns.
Got it. Okay. Fascinating. So if this case goes forward and it's blocked, then would the idea be each state would individually create a law or not create a law governing something like a 3D printed gun? That seems messy.
Yeah, I don't know. The whole thing is messy, and that's the kind of the nature of the internet. It's a really, really hard thing to police. And there have been questions since the beginning of the internet of what is free speech and what is inciting violence, or where do we draw the line?
Yeah. Making a parallel to another situation we saw recently where Facebook agreed to basically limit how people can target ads based on existing discrimination laws. And they've done something similar with political ad regulations. They're regulating political ads the same way that a ad on TV or an ad on the radio would be regulated. Is there an analogous regulation for gun manufacturers that perhaps could be put in place? Like, you can't 3D print a gun unless you have a manufacturer's license or something like that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the New York Times brought up a good point in their coverage of this, which is that making guns at home is not really new. You can very easily access a kit to, or the parts to make guns. So it's a pretty tricky thing to regulate. And those DIY guns are not regulated in the same way firearms are when you purchase them from a seller.
Really interesting issue. I'm looking forward to following this one. And again, I'm just excited long term about 3D printing. I feel like it is one of those technologies. It's one of those technologies that would be cool to see it have a bigger presence. All right. I covered a piece of news out of China this past week involving Starbucks and Alibaba, the big e-commerce company that competes with Amazon on a variety of fronts in China and is increasingly a global powerhouse. They have an office here in the Seattle region as well. Starbucks and Alibaba are teaming up for delivery and also integrating their apps in China in a lot of interesting ways. And if you're not in China or if you've never been there, it's hard to understand really the presence that Alibaba has through all sorts of different services. So this partnership between Starbucks and Alibaba is really significant for Starbucks. It's going to allow them to reach a whole ton of different consumers in China that it wouldn't have otherwise. About 500 million consumers in China using these apps are going to have a Starbucks online interface integrated into the apps. And they're going to be delivering using one of Alibaba's existing food delivery companies. So this was a fascinating one to see.
Yeah, I was, my first thought when I saw that was Starbucks and Amazon are neighbors. And how did Amazon feel when they saw this announcement? Did they know about it beforehand? Are they Do they wish that they could be delivering for Starbucks?
Well, that's an interesting point because I actually have been meaning to look back into this. A few years ago, Starbucks and Postmates started doing a pilot program for coffee delivery in Seattle. We actually tested it out when it happened. I don't know what happened to that. And I've actually asked the Starbucks people, like, what's the state of that? Because clearly Starbucks is willing to partner with others here to do delivery. The thing about Alibaba, that the advantage they have over Amazon in China is that they are native. I mean, they are a homegrown company in China, and especially in China, that matters. And it's really a unique advantage and a big benefit for Starbucks that they're able to strike this partnership with Alibaba in China. And it'll be interesting to see how that impacts Starbucks' growth in really what's a growing coffee market. Like coffee in China is not a big thing, but it's becoming a bigger and bigger thing.
Yeah, it's interesting to see this against the backdrop of Amazon trying to become more of an international player, competing with things like Alibaba and Flipkart, which is an Indian company. And I know recently they allowed international sellers on their platform to try and compete in that international arena more thoroughly. And this to me is kind of a sign that they're not doing as well internationally as they could be. So it'll be interesting to see where that competition goes now that Starbucks has taken this pretty obvious side.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, Starbucks and Amazon have partnered more on like philanthropy in the Seattle area, things like the homelessness issue and doing joint donations to things like Mary's Place. But you don't really see them working together on the business side. And we've talked a lot about this in the past, actually. In some ways, they're coming at the world from two different directions, but becoming very similar. Starbucks started in the brick and mortar world, and they're increasingly going digital with things like mobile order and pay and all sorts of integrations of their rewards program into their app. And then you've got Amazon, which started in the online world, and they're becoming much more physical in terms of their presence with Whole Foods and all the bookstores. So to your point, Claire, I think these two companies, Starbucks and Amazon, are probably more inclined to be competitors than they are partners. And this partnership between Alibaba and Starbucks really drives that home. All right, that is a quick look at a couple of the big news headlines of the past week. We have a lot more coming up on The Week in Geek. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's Todd Bishop with Claire McGrain and Monica Nicholsberg. Monica, the bike share issue in Seattle, the regulations, the different companies and all their tactics, it's become kind of like a saga. And we had the latest twist in the soap opera this past week. Catch us up. What's happening? Because I've had a hard time tracking it all.
The wide world of Seattle bike share. Yeah, so we now know what the permanent bike share program in Seattle is going to be. For the past year, it's been a pilot, which allowed three companies, Spin, Ofo, and Lime, to enter Seattle and deploy bikes. And it was all just a test. Now, this past week, the Seattle City Council has approved the final fee structure that's going to govern bike share in Seattle. And it includes a $250,000 annual fee per company. So that's pretty hefty. We saw immediately after that, Ofo, the Beijing-based yellow bike share company in Seattle, announced that they're going to be pulling out. I think that there's a pretty important caveat to that, though, which is that they had already confirmed that there were going to be widespread layoffs. Some reports have them at like 50 to 70% of their U.S. workforce, and they're shutting down in many cities that didn't pass the fee. So it's possible that they're saving face a little bit with the fee.
And we should point out there was a really weird situation last week where notifications went out to Ofo users that they were going to be shutting down. They didn't say they were going to be shutting down in Seattle, but they were going to be
in your town is what they said.
And the people in some people in Seattle got that, and it was because of a potential glitch or strange situation where maybe those people had ridden bikes in other cities before.
Yeah, but you know, the person who tipped us off to it said they never had ridden a bike in another city besides Seattle.
So there was, over the weekend, some back and forth. First they were out, then they were in. But to be clear, they are now out. They're saying the yellow bikes are going to be gone from the streets of Seattle if they're not already.
They are not already. They told me that it should be by August 31st, they should have their plan for the bikes, and they're looking at opportunities to potentially donate them to community groups, but they just haven't finalized those plans yet.
Got it. So does that then open the door for another bike sharing company?
For two to three, actually. Right after the fee was passed, Lime immediately said, we're going to apply for a permit. We are staying in Seattle. They're pretty aggressive about this market. We still haven't heard anything from Spin. They've been pretty quiet lately, and so we're going to circle back with them and find out what's happening there. OFO is out, and the regulations that the city adopted allow for 4 companies to be here. So there could potentially be 2 or 3 new entrants.
Got it. So let's give people the color key. Lime, green. OFO, yellow. Spin, orange.
That's right.
So if you're looking around the neighborhood, that's what we're talking about.
But it's going to get really tricky if Uber decides to launch their jump bikes here, because those are sort of a reddish orange.
All right, we'll just call them red.
So question for you, Monica. I, having ridden 1 bike share in my life, have no idea what the difference is between any of these companies. And I'm curious, what do you think Lime has done to find success in Seattle that OFO did not do?
Well, I can say from personal experience, their e-bikes, their electric assist bikes, make a big difference for a lot of riders.
I will tell you, that was really the tipping point in my household. My wife was just getting back into bike riding again, and she would get nervous in a big urban environment where, you know, there's pressure if you're at a stoplight to get acceleration right off the bat. And those e-assist bikes are just amazing for that. And even the relatively cheap Lime bikes, the Limes, you know, they're not high-end e-bikes if you look at the landscape of e-bikes. Very nice to ride. And I agree with you, Monica. I think that was sort of the tipping point. Up to that point, they were pretty much at parity in terms of the quality of bikes. You know, you might get a crappy bike one day and on one service and not on the other. It was, but I think the e-bikes is really the tipping point. So, and I know you've been riding one more lately.
I have, yeah. I've never been a big cyclist. I lived in New York before Seattle and was too intimidated by the cars and the traffic. And then in Seattle, I was kind of intimidated by the hills. The other thing is that I have a dog who comes to work with me and is with me all the time, which, you know, 90% of the time makes it impossible to take a bike. But it's summer in Seattle, and the other day I wanted to get to the other side of Green Lake, which is where I live, and I was like, I'll take an e-bike, and it was thrilling.
So here's my bigger question, talking about e-assist and everything like that. I want the scooters. I disagree with some people who don't want them, just because I think they'd be cool in some scenarios. I know that the Seattle City Council was waiting until they formalized the bike share rules. Have we heard anything yet about the possibility of scooters?
I've spoken with SDOT, the Seattle Department of Transportation, and they are not considering scooters at this time. They're completely focused on the permanent bike share program, and they've actually sent letters to all of the companies in the U.S. operating free-floating scooter programs that said, if you expand here without our permission, we're going to fine you and we're going to confiscate your scooters.
Which is interesting, because there was the story from a couple weeks ago. Bird was actually advertising in Seattle for chargers, people who would go overnight and find the scooters, take them to their house, charge them. And so there was an indication that Bird might try some kind of end around and unauthorized launch in Seattle.
Yeah. And what's even more telling is that they were hiring for a community manager, which seems like something you would only do if you wanted to manage the community there.
Yeah. Fascinating.
I want to point to a Seattle Times Traffic Lab story. I think this sums up why I haven't been taking many of the bike shares. They tried just a ton of bike shares. They had reporters go out and, like, in their daily routine, just grab a bike and try and ride it to the grocery store or whatever. And about a third of the times, the bike they tried to get was just not rideable for one reason or another. That shocked me, that a third of the time you just wouldn't be able to use it, because first of all, it's just frustrating to have a one-third failure rate when you're using anything. And when you're riding a bike, especially around Seattle, especially on busy roads, you may not have all the proper safety gear. If something is slightly wrong with the bike, your brakes don't work, your pedal doesn't work, something like that, it could be really dangerous.
Yeah, it's true. And there have been some reports of people cutting brake lines on these shared bikes. So some of the companies actually issued warnings to their riders to check all of the gear and equipment before you jump on.
Yes, and wear a helmet.
I did wear a helmet.
Yeah.
It says Lime on it. It's the only one I have. It looked really cool.
We got one of those too at some kind of promotional event that they were doing. Anyway, yeah, those are really cool helmets if you can land one. Okay, last thing here, Monica, because I know a lot of folks out there are wondering, okay, I don't care about these bikes. All I care about is that they stop littering my neighborhood. what's the answer for them? Because wasn't there like a figure of like 20,000 or something like that?
Yep. Up to 20,000 bikes will be allowed on the streets. And one thing that we saw a lot at the city council meetings on this were people who were visually impaired saying that these are a huge hazard to them. So as part of the final regulations that the city is adopting, there is kind of an incentive for SDOT to create a way to enforce parking rules. And most of the fee, that $250,000 fee per operator, is going to go toward constructing 150 to 200 bike parking zones in the city, like they've been experimenting with in Ballard. Now, Todd, I know that you've noticed those in your neighborhood, that there are often just empty parking zones and bikes nearby that people leave. So that's why the parking enforcement component of it is going to be key.
Okay, so but wait. So how do they enforce it? Because I drop off my OFO, not my OFO anymore, my Lime bike, and I park it somewhere other than the nearby bike parking zone. Who are they going to find? Are they going to chase me down?
So they didn't, the incentive is to create a plan. It's not a plan for enforcement. It's to figure it out.
So Seattle.
So Jump, the electric assist bike company that Uber acquired, their bikes actually have a locking mechanism and you have to lock it to a bike rack to close it. So that's one potential option.
Like an actual bike rack, not just some kind of like drain spout or something like that.
Well, I don't know.
Okay. All right. That is the latest twist in the saga of the bike shares. All right, Monica, I know you've got to run to a news conference.
That's right.
All right. Looking forward to hearing details of that.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Claire and I will be right back with the Random Channel on The Week in Geek on GeekWire. Welcome back to The Week in Geek. It's time for the Random Channel, that moment of the week where we talk about all the random things we were buzzing about behind the scenes at GeekWire this week. It's Todd Bishop.
And Claire McGrain.
So Claire, you had one of the more random items on the site this past week.
Yes.
Tell us about this celebrity cat and her or his?
Her poop.
Her poop.
Her poop. A lot of my stories are heavier on the science. This one was more fun. So Lil Bub, who many listeners may recognize if they saw a photo of her, is an internet famous cat. She was kind of one of the early internet famous animals. She had a huge following on Facebook and YouTube, and still does. And she was born with a few kind of genetic problems that give her very short legs and big eyes, and her tongue always sticks out. She's just a darling. So she has been working with a startup based in Seattle. This startup is called Phase Genomics, and they basically sequence genomes of tiny little microorganisms, bacteria, things like that. And they focus on understanding the microbiome, which is all the bacteria that make up kind of different environments around us. And so they used poop from Lil Bub and another kitty called Danny, and discovered by analyzing their poop 22 kinds of bacteria that we did not know about before.
Like, this is a scientific breakthrough from cat poop.
Oh, yes, it is, Todd.
So what is the advantage? What's the value of knowing now about these bacteria?
So this is interesting because it gets into the microbiome and the huge movement happening right now around understanding the microbiome. And there's a few different ways people talk about this. One way is about health, like human health, because it's all the bacteria like in your gut. So if you go to like a wellness service, a lot of the times they'll look at the microbiome as one of the things that impacts your health. Because if you have too many of some kinds of bacteria, it can be bad. Too little of other kinds of bacteria, it can kind of throw the whole ecosystem out of whack. And the same is true for a lot of environments around us, the natural environment, like microbiomes in the air. There's all of this stuff going on. So the idea is, if we understand more about all of these various little bugs around us, we'll be able to be optimally healthy. So the bacteria that they discovered in Lil Bub comes from the same kind of bacteria that includes gangrene, tetanus, and colitis. Hmm. Those obviously can make you really sick. So it might be that they could be important to how the body works. They might impact human health. It could be that they make people healthier if they have them in their gut. So the idea is to understand what the gut of healthy, normal animals looks like, whether that be cats, dogs, horses, or humans, and then be able to figure out what is going wrong in people or animals who have something out of whack in their microbiome.
So was there any particular reason to use the poop from this celebrity cat as opposed to the poop from like my cat? other than just sheer publicity?
I'm so glad you asked. They're still looking for samples. You can send your cat poop in. Check Phase Genomics website for information on that. This is kind of the beginning of a bigger initiative that Phase Genomics, this company, is embarking on with Animal Biome and Kitty Biome, which are two kind of projects. Animal Biome is a company. Kitty Biome is more of a kind of citizen science project. So this is just the beginning. They kind of kicked it off with a well-known cat to lend some, you know, heft to it. I don't know if we would have written about this if it was any old cat poop. But because it was special cat poop, now everyone's talking about it.
It's funny you bring up the microbiome, because I've actually been learning more and more about the microbiome and other topics through a great new podcast, which is my random channel item. There's a podcast by the entrepreneur in Seattle named T.A. McCann and his Partners in Crime in one of his side projects. T.A. was the entrepreneur behind the company Gist, which was sold to Research in Motion, and he's now at Pioneer Square Labs, and he's done a lot of different projects. But his new podcast is called How to Live to 200, which is all about the different ways that people are optimizing their health and, in some cases, doing some pretty extreme things in terms of the food they eat, the exercise they do, and also just the measurements that they do of their body. And one of the things that he talked about was with Richard Sprague, who's an entrepreneur behind the site personalscience.com. And they had a fascinating episode about the gut microbiome and the whole idea of sequencing that, doing like genetic testing on that, which I learned is not exactly like regular genetic testing. Your gut microbiome can change day to day. And they talk about all the different implications of it. And it's interesting in part because we've talked about it a lot through the AeroVail program. And I was always curious why they didn't really rely as much as I thought they might have on the gut microbiome. And in part, I learned why not through this podcast. It's because it can be pretty variable.
Yeah, definitely. It's almost like its own little ecosystem. You know, if you think of a forest, then the amount of spiders spikes in the summer when it's hot, and the amount of animals who are out and about and not hibernating is obviously higher in the summer months. So it kind of goes through natural rhythms. And if there's something that interrupts it, say there's a fire, maybe all the deer move out of that area of the forest because there's not enough to eat. The same thing happens with your microbiome as you go through kind of natural cycles. And also as things upset the balance. Maybe you drink too much coffee and that harms some kind of bacteria, and then everything kind of is a domino effect from there. So that's really interesting that that the variability is why they don't rely on that too much. I think the other thing is also we just don't know very much about the microbiome right now, which is why it's such a big area of research. People really want to understand it. And right now it's very complicated. We can see kind of the tip of the iceberg.
Another episode that I really got a lot out of, in part because of the character behind it, of this podcast, How to Live to 200, was an interview that T.A. McCann did with Martin Tobias, who will be a familiar name to people who followed the Seattle technology and startup scene for a while. He was behind startups including Cashless, Imperium Renewables, Loudeye Technologies. He was at Ignition Partners. He's now with a company called Bulletproof Labs. And they're doing all sorts of interesting things down in Southern California. They're doing all sorts of interesting things with cryotherapy and float tanks. And Martin is just a fascinating character, larger than life. And it was really fun to catch up with him in the form of this podcast by listening to what he had to say. So if you want to check out that podcast by T.A. McCann, How to Live to 200, it is at livingto200.com. So that's living T-O and then the number 200.com. All right, that is it for the Random Channel, and that is it for the Week in Geek on GeekWire this week. Thank you for listening to the GeekWire podcast. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app. Just search GeekWire, that's all one word, in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. If you like what we do, consider leaving us a rating and a review. It really does help other people find the show. You can see more of our coverage at geekwire.com. The GeekWire podcast is produced by Claire McGrain. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Until next time, I'm Todd Bishop. We'll talk to you next time on GeekWire.